Listen to me. We can give it a try. I'll look you straight in the eye and pull you to me. What I'm gonna do next, I'll even tie it to your imagination. Do you hear me? If you don't understand, I'll take a hold of your hand and pull you near me. What I'm gonna do next, I'll even tie it to your imagination.
Welcome to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing the world of nonprofits, social justice, and activism. Right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And I am your host, Ethan Clow. And thank you once again for joining us on this wonderful Friday morning. It's been an interesting week this past little while here for all of us on the sector, as well as in the social justice and nonprofit world. Some of the big news includes some news from America, where the Supreme Court has struck down some more bans on gay marriage in various U.S. states, which, of course, has been championed by progressives for, well, ever. I mean, about time, of course. Ongoing disputes, of course, into how effective these will be. I'm sure that the states are going to appeal these rulings, and there'll be perhaps more legal battles. But again, it's actually shown that as time goes on, more and more states are coming on board with it. I think actually now more states in the U.S. allow gay marriage than those that oppose it. And of course, this is going to just be, you know, more political motivation for the progressives in American politics. And I think more difficult for conservatives in American politics who continue to harp on this and ultimately, you know, gnash their teeth at the idea of equality for everybody. It'll be interesting to see how the political right in America deals with this. I mean, will they eventually clue in that history has basically gone past them when it comes to the question of gay marriage and equal rights? I don't know. We'll have to see with the next presidential election coming up. I mean, maybe we'll see a more moderate, a more reasonable political right, or, you know, perhaps they'll continue to gnash their teeth and dig into the sand and fight this tooth and nail, in which case I guess we can expect to have Hillary Clinton as the next president. Anyway, enough about American politics. There's been some good news all around, actually. I mean, for one thing, hockey season is back, so once again we can start cheering for the Vancouver Canucks and, of course, cheering against the Toronto Maple Leafs. And the other, of course, big news, wonderful news we got over the week was that Twin Peaks is returning to the air after a 25-year hiatus. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Twin Peaks, I mean, one of the greatest, most amazing, thought-provoking shows that came out of the 90s really set the stage for things like X-Files and Lost and, you know, any kind of like modern-day weird detective TV show. I mean, True Detectives is obviously a perfect example of that. So, I mean, fantastic. Twin Peaks is coming back. If you haven't seen Twin Peaks, oh, you really have to check it out. You know, go and get the DVDs. Have a watch. Honestly, it will change your life. It is an amazing show. Just really good. I don't want to go on and on about Twin Peaks here on The Sector, but I just want to say, I have put my personal stamp of approval on it, and you know that means a lot, really. But enough with the banter. We have a fantastic show here on The Sector today. On the show today, we're going to be talking a bit about some activism here on campus, the launch of a new student newspaper called The Talon, and we'll get a bit of information about that. Additionally, we're going to be talking about some interesting news from America, including a controversial change to Columbus Day in Seattle and a few other American cities, perhaps signaling a bit of a change up here in Canada as well. We're also going to discuss the war on drugs, and specifically the concept of the, quote, war on drugs, and its effectiveness over the last decade or so, and the changing perceptions and attitudes that are coming about due to the failure of the war on drugs. As a special treat for our listeners. I'm going to include a bit of the recent episode of the Terry Project from here on CITR, which focuses on the war on drugs and the, again, changing perceptions that are going into this revolution in drug care. We're going to talk a bit about it on the show as well, but I figured why not go right to the source? And again, high quality stuff. We'll have links to the show notes where you can look up the podcast series yourself. And if you enjoy the little blurb that we're going to play, then I encourage you to check out more when you get the chance later on at home. Well, let's go to our first commercial break here on The Sector. When we come back, we'll get on with today's great content here on the show.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, the Rumpus Room, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
Wow. It sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus. Go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station.
Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on.
College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And we're back on The Sector here on CITR with me, Ethan Clow. Late last week, I attended a activist mixer here on UBC. An interesting opportunity to get together with like-minded progressive individuals on campus and sort of network, see what's going on, plan events, plan campaigns, that sort of thing. It was really interesting because it was put on by the Social Justice Center here at UBC. And, you know, obviously a bit of an uphill battle. The reputation of activism here at UBC hasn't exactly been glowing over the years. The campus has developed a kind of a negative reputation of being a bit apathetic in terms of political activism, in terms of progressive politics, and ultimately in terms of, you know, getting out there and performing and getting something done in terms of outreach. In terms of outreach or activism, just pure activism. So it was actually a really refreshing change of pace and really nice to see so many students who came out, people who are interested in representing various groups, various interests, and hopefully making campus a more dynamic place to go to school at, which is, you know, always is going to have a better impact than not, right? Of course, one of the big developments recently has been that UBC has gotten a new student newspaper called The Talon, which is designed to be a progressive, left-leaning paper focusing on issues related to leftist politics, related to various causes, the environment, civil rights, human liberties, et cetera, et cetera. Now, of course, the really good news with this is that it gives the campus a voice that can bring these concerns up and also encourage student participation. So if anyone's interested in actually writing for The Talon or getting involved, they're very open to that. I spoke with a couple of their members, their exec, and sound like great students who got, you know, a really good head on their shoulders. And they're really looking forward to producing some awesome content. So I'm probably going to invite some of them to come on the show at some point. And we can discuss a bit more about, you know, UBC's reputation for activism and how they intend to change that. So look forward to that. And if you're interested in learning more about the Talon, check them out online and consider writing for them. And if you, you know, go to school at UBC, definitely look them up and get involved with some local campus outreach. Well, let's shift the gears a little bit to discuss some social justice news that's been making the rounds lately. Now, if you're an American, the long weekend signifies a celebratory day known as Columbus Day, which is a day where I guess Americans sit back and think about Christopher Columbus sailing the ocean blue, discovering America. Now, the problem with that narrative, of course, is that Christopher Columbus didn't discover America. In fact, Christopher Columbus wasn't even the first European to discover America. We know that the Vikings were well ahead of him on that regard. And there's no Viking Day. Anyway, the point being, though, is that people have been living in North America for thousands of years. Why exactly are we celebrating the, quote, discovery of a landmass that has been well populated for a really long time? It's a little bit racist, a little bit overlooking sort of the indigenous culture and heritage of the people who lived in North America long before white Europeans arrived here. So to combat this and to hopefully start to change the cultural zeitgeist, as it were, for this particular egregious holiday, Seattle has become the second city in America to designate Columbus Day instead as Indigenous Peoples Day to reflect that Native Americans were in fact here in North America long before Christopher Columbus and other white Europeans arrived on the continent. So for our Canadian listeners who don't know about Columbus Day, that of course is on October 13th in America, which is usually the second Monday in October, and that will be the new Indigenous Peoples Day. Now the other American city who have done this is the first being Minneapolis, which also marked Indigenous Peoples Day. Now, this move is not without controversy, and I guess we could all expect that. The move has been criticized by Italian Americans who feel that the campaign against sort of Columbus Day is also racially motivated and that it discriminates against Americans of Italian descent. And a quote from the news article, quote, "For decades, Italian Americans celebrated not the man, but the symbol of Columbus Day. That symbol means we honor the legacy of our ancestors who immigrated to Seattle, overcame poverty, a language barrier, and above all, discrimination." Now, I think it's difficult to sort of discount the argument from Italian Americans saying that we've also been discriminated against, and this is part of our heritage, that we celebrate heroes of Italian descent. And that's, of course, a perfectly legitimate thing to do. I mean, Italians in America weren't exactly treated very well, and still dealing with a lot of discrepancies in terms of the way Italians are displayed in media, in terms of art and society in general. I guess the question, of course, is that is Columbus really the best spokesperson for that ethnic group? And I would argue that probably not. Columbus himself was a shady character in the best of times. Was an advocate for slavery, did some pretty despicable things, and wasn't exactly an explorer or a representative of the best of humanity. In many ways, sort of represented the worst of the age of exploration. So ultimately, I think that one thing that we should keep in mind is that while we want to celebrate the contributions of Italians in North America, perhaps there are better people, better heroes that we can look to from Italian history and culture that better represent the best of humanity and not so much the exploitation that Columbus represented. Even speaking in terms of the symbol of Columbus Day, again, that's even problematic as well, because what did Columbus symbolize? It was an extension of European power, of colonizing, you know, savage natives, of conquering new lands, of slavery, of enforcing a European worldview on an entirely different culture. These aren't necessarily things that themselves are worth celebrating. And in many cases, these are holdovers of some of the biggest problems in the world. Now, we'll have to see how this progresses throughout the American political landscape. Perhaps we'll see more communities get on board with the renaming of some of these civic holidays that don't necessarily reflect the best values of America. So that could be good news, and maybe that'll even spill over to Canada as well. Now, speaking of things that are spilling over to Canada, let's talk a bit about the war on drugs. Now, this has received a bit of media attention recently here locally in Vancouver, as well as across Canada, with regards to the notion that it's about time for Canada to officially move beyond the, quote, war on drugs strategy for dealing with addiction here in Canada. Back in 2001, the city of Vancouver passed a new set of drug laws that became known as the Four Pillars. This was a bit different than the standard war on drug approach, in which case the idea was to focus on these supposed four pillars of treatment, of law enforcement, of ways of reducing the transmission of STDs, and, you know, just general health and welfare. The question, of course, is the four pillars included a war on drugs component, a law enforcement component, where there was still a lot of a push to put addicts behind bars in prison and jail. Now, after seeing the success of places like Insight, and the sort of success that this is having across the world, where other safe injection sites, where other treatment facilities are opening in Montreal and Ottawa, hopefully, and around the world, it's led to a lot of questioning, well, maybe we don't even really need the punitive war on drugs component when it comes time to for treatment, for rehabilitation, and for curbing addiction. Now, despite the recent advents and the successes that we've seen from places like Insight and other treatment strategies that focus not on criminalizing drug use, but of treating it like a healthcare problem, despite those successes, we're not actually moving in that direction, particularly from a federal point of view. The Conservative government has really ramped up their rhetoric in terms of the war on drugs, of criminalizing drug use, of increasing prison sentencing for drug offenses, and it's led to a lot of people saying, well, this is mimicking, you know, an American-style system for combating drug use, and it hasn't worked in America at all. It's actually made the problem a whole lot worse. So now you have people who are going to jail and prison serving long terms for things like having possession of drugs, having possession of heroin, having possession of a couple of marijuana plants. Is that the best use of our prison space? Is that the best use of incarcerating somebody and limiting their potential to get better, limiting their potential to be rehabilitated, and, you know, ultimately destroying their family, their potential future career opportunities? If we're trying to limit the amount of people who are addicted and who are using, you know, drugs, drug trading and all that as a form of survival, if we want to limit that, is the best course of action to throw them in jail where they're not going to develop any new skills, they're not really going to get effective treatment, and they may just come out, you know, a better drug dealer than they went in? Now, the skepticism that the war on drugs is working and the belief that it's actually failed is not simply held by a bunch of, you know, left-leaning little creeps like me. They're, in fact, a majority view across the world. The Guardian in the UK recently reported on a massive study of Britons, and, in fact, the view was that 84% say that the war on drugs campaign is futile, that it's failed, and that law enforcement agencies cannot combat narcotics trade in the long term or short term. And the progress of this view is actually growing. The poll provided stats around 27% saying that Britain's drugs laws are not liberal enough. Now, a previous study in 2008 recorded the figure at 18%. So, in fact, people are coming around to this view as time goes on, as we see more evidence from science, like places like Insight, as well as more policy changes that are happening around the world in various European countries and Canada and America, showing an improvement that we just haven't seen with the war on drugs. And, you know, we have some great tests right now because of a couple U.S. states, Colorado and Washington. Colorado decided to legalize the sale of recreational marijuana, and it's been hailed as a success. They've actually reported reductions of crime in Denver, and the concerns about social breakdown have, well, they haven't happened. I mean, it's not like the city has crumbled into dust. It's kind of holding together. So with these examples, and of course, you know, we can all point at the Dutch examples, you know, when you legalize marijuana, you don't suddenly get this outbreak of crime and craziness. You seem to actually see a reduction in crime, and you also kind of see people, well, a reduction in addiction. So clearly there's something there going on. And now there is actually political will, or at least there is public urging of political will to add an asterisk to that, to make a change and to promote a different way of looking at the drug problem, as opposed to this kind of superficial, if you do drugs, you're going to jail, we're going to lock you up. That doesn't really solve any problems. One of the recent developments in taking a more social view of drug use and addiction has been the rise of drug treatment courts in Canada and the US. And these courts operate on the principle that a drug user is not a criminal so much as they are a person with a social health issue that needs to be assisted with. So these courts are open to people who may have committed minor crimes like shoplifting or theft or whatever. As long as they're not violent crimes, they can go through this system, and instead of getting thrown in prison or thrown in jail for, you know, 30 days or whatever, they're actually pushed into treatment facilities and they're given strategies and resources and support to help kick the addiction, get their life back on track, and avoid, you know, further crime. Now, these courts have actually shown a lot of success, both here locally in Vancouver and across Canada. But the problem is, there's only 6 of these courts in all of Canada. Now, in America, there's 2,800 drug treatment courts. So, clearly, if America is getting on the bandwagon of this, I think that Canada, a more liberal nation with a bit more history of taking a more compassionate view of addiction, should be promoting these courts more vigorously. Of course, the big problem is opposition from the federal government, and how that develops over the next little while will depend, of course, on the next big federal election. Hint, hint, vote, vote. You know, one of the big questions that arises out of any kind of discussion on the war on drugs is whether or not, fundamentally, is drug use a criminal issue or is it a humanitarian, compassionate issue? And what I mean by that, and this is something that I've been getting from the readings that I've been doing, and it's quite interesting, this notion of, is the criminal justice system the one that should be handling this at all, period? Our courts, lawyers, judges, and the police, are they, regardless of how liberal or forgiving the system is that system sufficient, or should this be completely viewed in terms of a healthcare treatment modality where the primary purpose is really never mind law enforcement, never mind crime and punishment, focus entirely on treating this as though it were a disease or a health concern? And we could go on and on about this issue and the importance of looking at drug addiction or the drug problem as a healthcare issue versus a political / law enforcement issue. But rather than me go on about it, after the break, I'm going to air one of the recent episodes of The Terry Project, which was broadcast here on CITR. And The Terry Project, for those of you who don't know, is a cross-faculty program designed to educate undergraduate students on pressing global issues like climate change, poverty, conflict, and disease. So they did a series on harm reduction, drug policy, and sort of the war on drugs. The most recent episode is available as of October 9th. So if you go on to CITR's webpage, you can get the full episode. I'm going to air a small sample of it. I hope you enjoy it. And if you have any questions or comments, do check out the Terry Project online. And we'll be back after this.
I imagined what it would be like to be a wizard. And then I pretended and acted in that way on the day.
Studies show that 9 out of 10 wizards prefer CITR 101.9 FM.
If we were to draw a graph of my process, of my method, something like this, Sir Ian, action. Wizard, you shall not pass! Cut! Sir Ian.
My name is David Scott. I play wide receiver for the University of British Columbia football team, and I'm here to discuss the Be More Than a Bystander program. Myself and a few other players were lucky enough to work alongside the BC Lions and EVA, the Ending Violence Association, to support this cause. The main goal of the Be More Than a Bystander initiative is to increase awareness of domestic violence against women. For more information on the cause, please visit Ending.
continued to fight the cops in the courts for years. It was an ugly, expensive battle that seemed to be going nowhere. Chris Nyrop, one of Lisa's colleagues, remembers that the Racial Disparity Project went after Captain Steve Brown in particular.
We speak to Chris on the ground level of Seattle City Hall, right near a fountain.
So he had been grilled under oath repeatedly about arrest practices. And for him, it was a point of total exasperation and exhaustion.
Chris tells us that in 2005, after 4 years of litigation, Captain Brown broke down and asked the Racial Disparity Project one simple question.
Assuming everything you guys say is true, what would you have us do differently? And that was kind of a wake-up call for us because we'd never really thought about that before. And really, we only had two answers, both of which were snarky and flippant. One of which was end the war on drugs. You do that, you don't have a problem anymore. Well, that wasn't going to happen any day soon. And the second answer to that question was start arresting white drug users, like 4 or 5 times as many white drug users as you're arresting now. And that wasn't an answer that we wanted to give either. So here he is, he's posed this question. The only answers we have are just non-viable. And so we were like, what would we have the police department do differently?
Is it just a rhetorical question, or is he actually interested in your answer?
He was totally interested. He is not a rhetorical man, and he was totally interested in the answer. So it took us, a few months.
Here's what Lisa and Chris came up with. Get low-level drug offenders into treatment instead of jail. So Chris and Lisa set up a pilot program that offers counseling services to known criminals.
So it's sort of like turning the pyramid on its head of normal worthiness analysis, right? Like we're going to prioritize the people who are doing crime because it's not a human services program. It's really a crime prevention program using human services tools.
But Lisa wants to go even further. She wants to get the courts out of the picture entirely. She wants cops to bring suspects to a program instead of booking them and taking them to jail. At a council meeting, she asks an assistant chief of police what he thinks about the idea.
What would you think about directly taking people to this program? And he was like, oh, no. Once we have probable cause to arrest someone, we're not going to let that person go. The community wouldn't want that.
It's blasphemy. It went against everything that we had ever been taught. As far as drug use, drug sales, drug possession.
So Captain Brown is in a tough spot. His officers think that Lisa's the enemy, the person who's been calling them racist for so long. And her new idea went against decades of policing orthodoxy. But Brown could see that the traditional criminal justice approach wasn't working. So in 2011, backed by $1 million of funding from not-for-profits like the Ford Foundation and Open Society, Seattle launches its Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program, or LEAD.
You're listening to the final chapter of The Four Pillars Revisited, a series brought to you by the TAI and the University of British Columbia. After a short break, we take you to the streets of Seattle to see LEAD in action. If you're a regular listener of The Terry Project, you already know that this is our season-opening series, The Four Pillars Revisited. The TAI asked us to spend all summer looking at Vancouver's drug policy, and so we did. And if you like what you hear on this radio program, you'll definitely like The TAI's work. So check them out at thetaii.ca, that's TheTyee.ca.
Going down by Lazarus, they just had a big shooting.
Yeah, I heard. Yeah, we're not going to go that far.
No, that's a bad area there.
Yeah, we'll stop at Pike and Pine. Yeah.
We're walking along 3rd Street in downtown Seattle. It's been one of the rainiest days of the year, but the sun's just come out. We're with Tony Kaguchi. Tony's in his 30s, and he's wearing a Seahawks sweater and cargo pants. He's one of LEAD's case managers. That means he works with clients that he's referred to, directly from the Seattle Police Department.
Now what we're rolling on here is the blade, and it's a
pretty open air, you know, drug market. Now it's interesting because the Blade in the daytime, you know, you also have professionals, you know, going to work, you have tourists and everything else. After about 6 o'clock, when most of the professionals go home, then the people of the street really own it. And so you see, they all come out.
You know, I have family members that have had addiction issues. Once upon a time, I've had some addiction issues with alcohol. And so that kind of really opened my eyes to how prevalent addiction is. You know, I consider myself pretty fortunate to be out of that lifestyle and into a cleaner, sober life. And so I want to just give other people the opportunity.
Wow! Wow, this is one of my old clients.
Yeah.
Hey, get out of here, man!
What's up,
my man?
Oh man, good to see you, brother.
Good to see you.
Yeah, man.
What's going on?
Long story, man.
Yeah.
You got time?
You still got my number?
Yep, I still got your number. I just don't have the phone service.
Okay. So you down here?
Yeah, I'll be here.
Tony has been counseling since 2008. So he runs into old clients on the street all the time. We can hardly walk for a minute without someone walking up to him and giving him a high five or a hug. He explains that these are sometimes happy meetings, and they're sometimes sad meetings. This time, it's a little in between.
And so I know a lot of his story, a lot of his background, a lot of his struggles through the years that he's had with addiction. And I could just tell he's... Doesn't seem like he's doing too bad, but I don't think he's doing too good either. So
yeah,
we're gonna see. Well, because you know he had a job and he was got connected back with his kids and stuff. But the fact that he said I'll be here when you get back, that kind of gives me a clue that
like he's looking for some help.
Looking for some help, yeah.
So I guess that's a good thing too.
That's a very good thing. Yeah, that's a very good thing. So we're gonna help.
Our first agenda item, we're going over the LEAD program. We do have.
Down the road in City Hall, there's a meeting about LEAD. This is where the high-level political decisions are made, the decisions that will affect Tony and his clients.
We have one stated goal for LEAD. And
this is Chris Nyrop again.
This sentence here was the result of hours and hours and hours of conversation between a bunch of people sitting in the same room and a great deal of wordsmithing to come up with that.
The sentence on the board reads, LEAD's goal is to improve public safety and public order and to reduce the criminal behavior of people who participate in the program.
There are two television crews taping the meeting. Around the table, there's police officers, there's a professor, a lawyer from the ACLU, the sheriff, the prosecutor, the Business Improvement Association, and the Public Defenders Association, the organization that Lisa and Chris work for. They're the same people who are calling the SPD racist, and the same people who said that we need to end the war on drugs. But today, they're leading the Seattle Council meeting.
Okay, Lisa, we have some other agenda items, so why don't you sort of take us home and give us our orders or tell us what you have in mind here.
I've been waiting so long for that invitation, but...
the give us our orders part?
Yes, exactly.
There are three uniformed officers at the table. One is a captain, and her name is Diane Nollett.
What we get with LEAD that we weren't getting with any other programs, first of all, is the cooperation. It was a forced cooperation at first. I myself was voluntold that I would be doing LEAD by a commanding officer. But it really has evolved into an incredible collaborative effort between people that were previously at odds with one another.
Who would those people be?
Well, the police department and the ACLU, the police department and the public defender's office, basically the police department and everyone. Let's just be honest. I think it was all good. There were no bad intents. There was no malice. But what it is law enforcement is traditionally focused on enforcing the law. And I think what this program has done is it has really forced us to reframe the conversation about are there other ways to provide for public safety? And I don't know that that conversation, at least in the Seattle Police Department, had ever taken place.
LEAD offers you two doors. Through one door, you've got the traditional criminal justice system. Maybe that'll get you into drug court. but most likely it'll just get you into prison. Through the second door, there's no sentence at all. You just go straight to Tony and the LEAD program.
The mission is public safety. It's not law enforcement. We want to make sure that officers have some flexible approaches. And many times, everyone at this table wearing a uniform has had to make an arrest when there were no other options and when it just didn't feel good.
That was another uniformed officer. And this is John Urquhart, the sheriff of King County. He says that this program is led by the boots on the ground.
The only thing I would add is if there was one critical part, and you've talked about it already, one critical part of LEAD, I believe, it's the discretion of the street officers, the boots on the ground, to make that decision. Really pretty amazing from a management standpoint. If you give people discretion, they will rise to the occasion. Not everybody, but they will rise to the occasion. And that really has made the difference. We all sit around the table here. Everybody at this table sits at the 10,000-foot level and too often by decree decide what's going to happen in the street. This LEAD is the first time that I'm aware of that we've done something differently, and it's working. And the officers, 90% of them, they love it.
Only certain squads in the Seattle Police Department actually use LEAD. And it's the bicycle cops and transit police in downtown Seattle.
Because they say culture trumps planning every time. And I think it was important that we went with our most visible kind of hard charging units to start. I think otherwise it would have been, rather than being paradigm shifting, it would have been just another social program. It would have been just another hug a thug thing that the police department's doing, and it's not going to go anywhere. And if we wait it out, it'll go away. And I think by putting it into the units that people compete to get into and people really want to be there and they're doing good police work, really spoke to, we're taking this seriously and we want to give something different a chance.
This meeting didn't come out of nowhere. This is the product of years of Lisa's political campaigning. She says she got all the important Seattle community groups behind this idea, even the business community.
The community has been working with the police department for years, downtown neighborhoods, to look at public safety issues. We have drug dealing and a lot of addiction issues that face downtown. And we go to meetings month after month, and we identify, a hot spot or a problem area, and the police would go and check it out. Maybe an arrest would be made, and that person would probably spend a few days in jail and come back out, be back in the community.
This is Don Blakeney, the head of the Business Improvement Association for Seattle's Chinatown and International District.
It's that same cycle that you had a very specific tool to use, and you were using it. But it was, I think there was at one point someone counted 54 people in Belltown were arrested 2,800 times. And, you know, it was kind of like Groundhog Day all around Seattle, where you just kind of keep coming to these meetings and we weren't making an impact. And so from a business community perspective, it was pretty frustrating. And when we heard, you know, what was going on in Belltown and how this was a new approach, that hope and that that understanding that it's not just arrest and then back on the street, but that this is actually looking at the roots of the problems, gives us a tremendous amount of hope.
Lisa convinced all of the important community groups that LEAD was a good idea. And so it had the politicians thinking, if we want to get elected, we probably have to back this. So they did, and they pledged $800,000 to expand the program into a second neighborhood.
That's like you down here. It's down here the same way.
Yeah.
Hey, Lope.
Hey.
So, Lope.
How you feeling?
My Lope.
We're across town in Evergreen Treatment Center. There's a walk-in clinic on the ground level. There's free coffee waiting for the clients. And two case managers sit at a desk near a kitchenette chatting with people who walk in.
And as we sit in the conference room, Tony remembers the first few times he went down to the police station to pick up a LEAD client.
Clients were looking at us like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, really? First of all, I'm not getting booked for the charge that they just picked me up for. And you're offering me services like housing and food and identification assistance and whatever. And so there's a lot of skepticism at first. 3 years later, now, you know, the streets know about us. And so, you know, clients don't really fight it. But I remember there was a couple of clients that just were like, no, man, nah. Are you guys going to book me after I leave? Or is this for real? You know, and it's like, yeah, it's real.
Almost all of the LEAD participants are homeless when they join the program, and most have a dual diagnosis of mental illness and drug dependency. LEAD's core philosophy is to give these people services and supports without requiring them to get clean and sober.
You have to change your definition of what success is, because success doesn't necessarily mean abstinence for everybody. Success could be this person is not committing any more crimes and stealing and is a menace to the community anymore. Yeah, he might still be using his drugs, but he's using them in his house and he's not, you know, causing any trouble. That's success.
But you keep working with people who start using again?
Yes.
And you keep working with people who maybe don't show up for a while.
Oh my goodness, that's every day. You know, just today I was just telling you I had a client scheduled for a certain amount of time, but he flakes on me. And so if that is the case, I'll go and find them.
Oh, here's one of my clients right here. I'll go say what's up to this guy.
One of my colleagues calls us guerrilla case management. We go out there with our backpack and our cell phones, and we engage with clients on the street in their areas. So if that means we have to engage with a client in an open-air drug market, that's what we do.
Tony walks up to a middle-aged black man wearing glasses. This is Lonnie.
Missed you the other day.
Lonnie gives us a sheepish look and talks to Tony quietly, almost under his breath. Tony asks Lonnie very gently if he's doing okay. The two men huddle together as they talk, and they pause for a second as a large van full of sightseers zip by.
Tony buys Lonnie teriyaki chicken for lunch, and he asks him if he wants to try and get clean. Lonnie seems open to it. He says he'll try detox. When the food arrives, we say goodbye to Lonnie and continue up the road.
Lonnie's one of those cases that's kind of sad because, believe it or not, you know, he had a job here, the Hard Rock Cafe.
Yeah.
Doing dishes. He was in recovery. Had about 2 years clean.
Yeah.
Living in a clean and sober house. Had money in his pocket, doing well, and he slipped and went backwards and has never quite been the same since. And so I told him to call me on Friday. In the meantime, between now and Friday, I'll call detox, get him a bed date so he can go into detox and then treatment.
Do you feel confident that he's going to actually call you on Friday?
You know, he will call me on Friday. What I don't feel confident about is Wednesday, because Wednesday is when he gets his Social Security check. And the pattern with Lonnie is that when he gets paid, he disappears. And then we start the cycle all over again.
Addiction work is very, very difficult. For example, I've had three clients that have died in the last year, you know, for various reasons, but all tied to their addiction. That's the reality of our work. It's very difficult to have to sit with that, the emotions of all that. And you kind of feel like sometimes like, wow, am I making a difference?
And we're back on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, your host. We're going to end that episode of The Terry Project there. If you'd like to hear the full episode and read along with the added written content as well as their show notes and information, check them out online. You can visit them at www.terry.ubc.ca. And of course, the podcast information and broadcast schedule is available at citr.ca. So you can get all of the background information on all of their great work going into the war on drugs, as well as harm reduction drug policy and all the other great topics that they cover. Well, we're running out of time here on The Sector, so we're going to wrap things up. This is Ethan Clow, your host, saying thank you for listening. We'll see you all next week here on The Sector.